When Bret Easton Ellis published American Psycho, his third novel, in 1991, the best-selling book was considered so toxic for its graphic scenes of violence and sex that it was legally only allowed to be sold shrink-wrapped in some parts of the world, including Australia. Bret Easton Ellis has been no stranger to headlines and controversy ever since. Now he has returned to the fray with his first book of essays, White, his first book in a decade. Siobhan Callaghan and Dave Lorden have been reading White and they're with me in studio at the moment. He originally was going to call this book Privileged White Male, but his publishers talked him out of it. And since I hear the from you, Dave, I'll set you now. Go, let's go handy now and find out a bit about the man before we start into it.
Yeah.
But what does that tell us about the nature of the provocateur that perhaps Bret Easton Ellis is?
Yeah, I think he's looking around for the buzzword or the buzz phrase that'll cause the reaction and get the attention and get the media to focus on him and get him the interviews and get him onto the Tucker Carlson show as he's been on in the last couple of weeks in the States, and you know, get all the right wing social media have a huge interest in him since his book came out. So I think in terms of a marketing strategy and a PR strategy, it's probably working for him. Is it really a good starting point for an intellectual analysis or reading of where we have in the world today? I don't think so. I think privileged white male, you know, it's certainly, since it's a buzzword, okay, whoever's using it, and it's often used in very political context, and it's often used ironically. I mean, there's nothing original about using the term privileged white male ironically. I mean, half the Twitter and Facebook profiles, you know, have got them describe themselves ironically as privileged white male. You know, so you know,
commas are in italics.
Exactly.
Whatever,
yeah. So it's not new, it's not original, and it's cunningly designed to draw attention on the book, I would say. You know?
And the book, which is sitting in front of Dave right there, Siobhan, it has a white cover and then just the block capitals white and his name on it. Even paring it down to White, I suppose the fact that he even told us what he wanted to call it at first tells us that he is, even with the word white, he's being provocative.
I mean, I think one of my main issues with this book, and I think it's to do with the Ellis trying to convert his writing style to the essay form, is that it's a style without substance. So it's all bluster in terms of Ellis's approach to provocation, rather than delve into this so-called buzzword privileged white and explore these terms, he kind of flings them around and mashes them up with other issues and uses them to poke fun, but no one's laughing in that. There's a laziness to it in terms of his disengagement throughout the text.
I can already hear, if he were listening, he'd be saying, here goes the liberal elite on me again.
Yeah.
You know, that they're just going to dismiss me in those terms, because that's how he would probably refer to many media, media people and commentators, Dave.
Yeah.
Would you answer him if he said that?
First of all, I'd say, you know, let's get serious here, okay? There's basically three theses in this book, which is a bit of a mashup, okay, as Siobhan has said. The first is that, for example, people shouldn't resist Trump, Bolsonaro and so on, simply accept the way the world is going and do nothing about it, okay? The second is that young people are gone soft, okay? And the world has gone bad because young people are gone soft and they're so offended and so on. No. And the third is that free speech is under attack from the left. Now, I would take issue with all of those three things, which the book is here. You know, I don't agree or believe with any of that. Yeah. It doesn't present any kind of counter case in the book.
Well, let me start with one. Yeah. Let's start with the Trump one, which you're saying is one of the major theses within the book, that people like Trump, Bolsonaro, etc., Le Pen, I suppose, in France as well, that they shouldn't be resisted, they should be accepted.
Yeah.
Does he tease out any idea of, listen to the arguments that these people are making and fight the argument rather than, you know, play the ball, not the man? Does he get stuck into any kind of discussion
No. I mean, it's just repeated, long-winded, insults aimed at straw groups, such as Generation Whoosh, which, as far as I'm concerned, doesn't exist, okay? Or straw men, which includes his millennial boyfriend, which we don't know whether that boyfriend exists or not, to be honest with you.
Well, we've no reason to expect that he doesn't.
But such a straw person, I believe, as a writer, that Ellis is creating a straw person, perhaps out of a real person, you know? And it just, it doesn't
wouldn't enter into any sort of deep analysis or offer any kind of a genuine intellectual defence of Trumpism or Bolsonaroism or far right, just simply that we should all get over ourselves and stop protesting and just accept and stop freaking out, okay? No, I think that's not a very serious approach to the world, because obviously since Trump has come to power, you know, for example, there's been a 400% increase in attacks on people of colour in the United States, okay? So there is a link between the rhetoric that people like Trump have and an actual increase in the vulnerability and the violence of minority groups. So, I mean, you can argue that we should accept that and do nothing about it. For me, is actually agreeing with it and promoting it. Right. It's not objective. He's not being objective. He's fighting for Trump. He's fighting for the right. If this book didn't exist, then the White House would have had to invent it, as far as I'm concerned. Yeah.
The minute I mentioned the Trump thesis and Dave mentioned his, your hand was up immediately, Siobhan. So there must have been something in there that itched you or annoyed you. What was it?
In a sense, what I would be very cautious of with this book is not giving Ellis credit for what he doesn't do. In that I am myself a member of the so-called Generation Wuss. And so when I was presented with this book, I took my time to read it quite carefully and not fall into the traps of what punters like Ellis accuse us of. I thought, I'm going to read this and really think through it. But the material is simply not there. In that a lot of, as Dave said, a lot of the book circles around these kind of long-winded anecdotes about Ellis's friends within the Hollywood elite. He does at times point out that he is he's talking about quite a specific group of people in this book. He's talking about the Hollywood elite, the elite on either coast of, the liberal elite on either coast of America. And at points during the book, he almost gestures at relevance or at a pressing point, but then swiftly moves away.
What does he say about Kathryn Bigelow, for example? He attacks her. This was a Twitter argument, wasn't it?
In a way, the Kathryn Bigelow debacle kind of, I think, summarises my main issue with this book, in that, first of all, there's Twitter dominates this book in a way that the main takeaway from this book might be that Ellis should cut down on his screen time. Ellis tweeted about the director, Kathryn Bigelow, when she was nominated for her Oscar, and said, I have it here. He said, Kathryn Bigelow would be considered a mildly interesting filmmaker if she was a man. But since she's a very hot woman, she's really overrated.
Is that classic, right, here I go, this'll get them going, and people respond to it. Is that what he's doing? Is he doing anything more than just provoking and being that?
Maybe. My issue with this is that he gives this instinct. He gives it a solid 3 pages in the book where he talks about it and kind of has a faux intellectual kind of sensibility behind the point, but then moves on to say, first of all, bemoans those who were so-called offended by the tweet and called him sexist, says he was kind of half-joking and they should have gotten the joke, and then says that he'd never even seen the film. Right. So, in a way, reading White, I felt like I was marking a poor undergraduate essay where I continually was thinking, develop your argument, back up your point, don't move on, you know, stand by. So in a way, it seems to me that it's Ellis who wants to yell his opinion into a bubble and not be challenged.
However, Dave, you've both been speaking about the absence of real argument in this book, but he didn't get to be the writer that he is and the successful writer that he is from writing material that held no substance.
Well absolutely.
There must have been something there.
Absolutely. I remember I read Less Than Zero and American Psycho when I was a teenager, and you know, I was absolutely blown away by both those books. I felt with Less Than Zero that I had found a recognition of a generation of the 1980s and a representation of a generation in the 1980s which had kind of lost contact with any kind of moral purpose, okay? And that was put across very well in Less Than Zero. And in American Psycho, I read it at the time, and he intended it at the time as a vicious satire on American imperialism, on the violence that America carries out throughout the world.
And none of that is present in White at all,
those books
it?
Had, you know, genuine defamiliarization, genuine shock, you know, great style, you know, allegorical power, all of those things, but there's nothing like that here. There's nothing new, there's nothing surprising, there's nothing in the world. There's no stylistic coherence. You know, that's our tonal coherence, which he would have had in those two books to huge effect. Now, whatever you might say about the politics, say, of American Psycho, and I know there's huge criticisms of that, you can't argue that it's not a work of art, you know what I mean, and which had an aesthetic coherence, which this doesn't have.
Let's go to the second of the theses that Dave mentioned there, which, and since you are you have defined yourself and identified yourself as a member of the so-called Generation Worst. What way does he present that argument? And I'm even afraid to ask you, how does he develop it? What does he say about Generation Worst that's so annoying him?
I mean, so a lot of the conversation around Generation Worst centralises and kind of circles around Ellis's boyfriend. So when he gives the backstory of this, a lot of it began with kind of what he felt were humorous tweets about essentially this intergenerational relationship, what happens when there's a 20-year age gap and they see the world differently. He moves this on to then talking about the kind of, I suppose, despair on behalf of so-called Generation Worst when Trump was elected into the White House. And the cult of victimhood is something that he focuses on at points within the text. So I think that's how he characterises Generation Worst. And as I said previously...
Does it go beyond that then? After he's characterised the generation, does he develop any argument as to why the response is what he says it is?
I mean, he has the grace to say that it's not our fault. He jokes and he says that if I had been raised by these helicopter parents, maybe I would have been the same. It's not their fault. So he reins it back in.
Is it the bad parents who are to blame in his mind for what he calls Generation Worst?
It's difficult to say because so much of his anecdotes focus on going back and essentially very long dinners he had in nice Hollywood restaurants. So it's difficult to extrapolate too much because he focuses so much on style and stylish ways. So particularly when he discusses the cult of victimhood, he has quite a long paragraph where he lists things off and it's quite snazzy. He says, if you think like this, you should get a doctor. But in that, he mashes in a number of different social movements that are quite different and doesn't bother to pull them apart.
Is there anything in this book for either of you? Let's go to you, Dave. I know you mentioned the argument about the left, but I think you've got, like, he has moved from then the anti-imperialist that he was
to a different place now. He's poacher turned gamekeeper, I would say. You know, I mean, he kind of reminds me of William Wordsworth, who in the 1790s and up until 1805 or 6 was, you know, a great supporter of radical change and then became the Queen's poet for the last 40 years of his life and didn't happen to write any good poetry for the last 40 years of his life.
Is there anything in White that reminds you of people who are obsessed with
Hollywood gossip, you know, there may be, for people who are interested in what you might call it Bret Easton Ellis's process, I'm not one of those people, to be honest with you. There may be such people out there, you know. I don't think this book has a big audience, to be honest with you.
I would say that the particularly the early chapters where Ellis evokes his childhood in Sherman Oaks, California, are really compelling reading. He describes this childhood
that's sort of a memoir, isn't it?
This is one of the issues with the book, where I think that personal essay is not a get-out-of-jail-free card for engaging properly with issues if you're going to raise them. But they are, the man can write, and we know this, and they are quite compelling. I think if you're a massive fan of Ellis, you will get backstage information about particularly the filming of Less Than Zero. He's quite an astute arts critic. So, I mean, it's not trash, but it's just if you want to get an interesting insight into issues, it's not white trash.
All right, okay. That's a kind of a half a recommendation, sort of, but not at all either.
Go back
and read
Less Than Zero. You know,
Less Than Zero is where you want us to go, Dave.
His first book.
Okay,
yeah.
That's it. Dave Lorden and Siobhan Callaghan speaking to us there about White by Bret Easton Ellis, which is published by Picador.